Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose Washington's policy issues and prescribe needed solutions. Here's your hosts, Joe Grogan and Eric Ulan.
Welcome back to DCEKG, where we diagnose DC policy diseases and prescribe needed solutions. I'm Joe Grogan, and joining me as always is Eric Ulan. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce economist and author Jeremy Weber to the podcast. Jeremy is the author of Statistics for Public Policy, A Practical Guide to Being Mostly Right, or at least Respectably Wrong. He is a professor of environmental and energy policy economics at the University of Pittsburgh and has held numerous notable roles in government, including chief economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors and research economist for the Economic Research Service. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe and Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So I love this book. I'm going to be honest with you. I heard you on Russ Roberts' Econ Talk, which just aired a couple weeks ago, and I missed the beginning of the podcast. I was a little bit distracted, so I didn't hear your name or the background, and I started listening to it, and the way you were describing the book and how to use statistics in public policy decision-making, I started to perk up, and then you started to use examples, and I was like, wait a second, who is this guy? You know, because I figured out pretty quickly we overlapped in the Trump White House, and then we get to the end, and I figured out who you were, and I ordered the book that day and sent an email to have you come on the podcast, and I got the book a few days later, and I just cranked right through it. So thanks so much for joining. It's great to see you.
Great. Well, and I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed the book, and also that the Econ Talk podcast was engaging. Hopefully we can build on that here.
Great. So let's talk about why you wrote the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the short answer is my experience screamed to me that there was a need for it. And I thought many people, if this is done well, are going to be greatly helped by this book. Students, non-students, people who want to have more confidence in using statistics, people who just want to be more effective and clearer and more accurate and honest in their use of statistics. So that's what motivated me. Now, there's a lot of anecdotes or points throughout my work experience where, you know, a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, this is something that should be included in a statistics class for policy students or really any students who are learning quantitative methods for practical purposes, policy especially. I realized in working at a federal statistical agency, later at the Council of Economic Advisors, and then teaching in the middle, I realized my teaching isn't doing what it ought to do. I'm not preparing these students to be very helpful to their bosses, to their clients, whoever it is. And so that motivated. I could talk a lot about light bulb moments where I thought, you know, this is something that I was never taught, but I wish somebody had.
So let me ask you this, because I know Ulan's going to want to jump in. So I got to get another couple in before he runs. A threshold question for me as an English major and attorney is, why teach statistics if it's not going to be taught to be used in practical situations? It one thing I gathered from your book, and I would say I learned it confronting public policy questions and my experience in government, is you frequently, and you learn this lesson painfully, somebody shows up tremendously credentialed, they drop a bunch of data and they're explaining stuff, and when you're young or naive, it doesn't matter about youth or age, you give that person deference because you might not, because you don't understand what the hell they're talking about. And you're like, wait a second, I didn't take statistics, or this person is so much smarter than me, I only took basic statistics. So you give this person deference without having the guts to say, hold on, and pressing them and saying, can you explain that again? Explain it to me like I'm a Labrador retriever. Put the tennis ball here. Look at me and explain it again and again and again. And frequently you discover this person doesn't know what the hell they're talking about, or they were talking past you or tried to BS you, or you just weren't tracking. So what is the point? What is accounts for this disconnect for universities to teach statistics and it is of no limited practical use?
Well, I'll just start by saying your experience is not unique. Like, I experienced that too. I've seen it. Other people have told me that it is common. Why does it happen? And why is our statistical training what it is? The reality is the people who teach statistics are people who use statistics for a conversation with other similar focused technical academics. And they develop their own language, their own comfort with the jargon, and they know the rules of that game, the norms of that game, and that's what they're playing. That's what they're playing in their professional life. And then when they teach, that's what they reflect in the same standards, the same sophisticated methods that they dump on students. They are training students to play the game they play. And then when those folks go out, well, let's just talk about the professors. When they go out to speak to a broader audience, oftentimes they're still in that academic conversation where it's an unending conversation. People are familiar with the jargon, even though they've perhaps forgotten or never really learned deeply what those words mean. They're very comfortable with the jargon. They throw that out. And so people are either lost or they are impressed, but they don't understand. The students, you know, the poor students, they walk out of the class with some of the jargon, but they really don't know what they're doing for the most part. They don't have, the ones who don't have confidence to use what they've been taught are the ones who probably are the more responsible ones. They're like, you know, I didn't really get that. And I don't want to go out and use that in a context where I might say something stupid. We might make a bad decision. And then the other half of the students, you know, they're tooled up and they think that they have understanding, and they go out and, you know, run over people, but don't equip them with understanding. So I think it really has to do with the teachers, what their professional experience is, and then what they hand down to students. It's rare that you have a statistics class that's taught by somebody who regularly serves a client who's in a decision-making position.
So, Jeremy, this book is great, and I really appreciate it because it's for this generation now, as revelatory as a Numeracy by John Allan Paulos was a generation ago, in terms of just trying to ground people in the best way to think about and approach these questions. As Joe says, especially with me too, a liberal arts major, of just, hey, wait a second, let's stop, let's break this down, let's think about what you're saying, could you explain this to me? But you mentioned at the beginning that you realized you weren't doing as well as you could, especially in the academic context, being able to teach your students the art here, the science and the craft of statistics. Is part of that problem the entire education enterprise right now? I mean, in terms of what's emphasized and what's not in college, what we do, especially in our early years professionally or not. I get that professors sometimes are the most self-analytical in terms of how can I do a better job, but are there other reasons, other ingredients for this shortcoming that so many people have when it comes to both how to think about and ultimately apply critical analysis to statistical claims?
That's a good question. If I think about organizational change, whether it's a bureaucracy in the government or a university, you know, they're often, they don't change when they're insulated from pressure to change. I think that's often true in the university. Maybe that's changing some with enrollment trends and questioning of the value of the education. So that's, I think that's in part why, in a way, the university is quite conservative in the sense, not in the political sense, but in the sense that it does today what it did yesterday. And so we've been slow to change, even as I think, you know, students often walk away from SAS classes not satisfied because with what they're getting. And now I'm just thinking out loud here, the consumer in this case, the student, you know, they don't often know what they want. A typical consumer, you know, knows the car they want to buy. They know when they've been sold a car that's a bad car. You know, if you're coming into a stats class, like, you know, you really don't know that there's a much better car out there that you should be buying. And so you just go through it. You know, you read that book, you take that test, and you just think this is what it is. And we do that year after year. And so it's an interesting case, the university bureaucracy and the student as consumer. We don't get the consumer demanding, and maybe that's changing, hey, I want something more practical, more useful. They kind of almost, I think, have to have a taste of it somewhere to then say, hey, my class should be much more like what I heard on this podcast, maybe.
Can I ask about a specific issue that you touch on in your expertise, which is the property values in Pennsylvania versus Texas when there are gas wells on the property? This is always, again, I'm not an energy expert. I love filling up my gas tank, but it's always this thing in the ether as a native of the Northeast that gas lines are going to decrease your property values. Sinking well, fracking is going to decrease property values. Gas wells are going to decrease property values. Can you walk through the, as you dove into it, what you discovered and the lessons learned from that investigation?
Yeah. So a finding from the literature on fracking, say, and housing values is that whether or not the presence of fracking, you know, drilling oil and gas wells that then are stimulated by this mix of fluids injected down, whether or not that leads to depressed property values or higher property values is very context dependent. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's not just context dependent, it's policy dependent. So in the example that I've studied in Texas, somebody still sinks a well, a valuable well, a well that's productive. That well's value enters the property tax base as if somebody had just built a McMansion next door and was now being taxed upon it to generate revenues for the local government, for the schools. Obviously, that's... There's a lot of reasons why we would think more of those things would lead to greater public services or lower taxes that would increase housing values. And that's what we did see in the case of the Barnett Shale in Texas. In Pennsylvania, there's really no mechanism for the wells to generate local revenues. So then you're just left with, well, is there employment effect and by extension, an increase in the demand for housing? Is that offset by any disamenities from more trucks on the road? And the best study that's been done so far in Pennsylvania finds that on average, there's not really an effect. For a subset of homes that are on well water and have a well track nearby, there was over the period looked a decrease, right? Because there was a perceived risk of groundwater contamination. So it really varies based on not just context, Texas, Pennsylvania, but within Pennsylvania, you could go from slightly, for different subgroups, slightly positive effect, neutral effect, and negative effect.
So the lesson learned on that is not, is you need to broaden your aperture on the data that you bring in. Like, you can't just look just at Pennsylvania. You've got to look at Texas, number one, or other states, and you've got to look at the policy choices that would affect the property value. Like, Pennsylvania, for whatever reason, didn't decide to build in the energy value, the energy extracted into the property tax base. Texas did. So it's really not, does fracking increase or decrease your property values, which is the cherry picking of the information for those that oppose fracking. It's what policies affect the property values, separate and distinct from the existence of the, well, not separate and distinct, in addition to the existence of the energy on any particular tract. Is that fair?
Yeah, you could say, are there, what are the institutions that kind of mediate the effect of the industry on the livability of the community, the desirability of living there? You know, it's not like with policy in general, it's not like, oh, what happens? We would think that if you give like a human a certain substance, that the human body, like whether the body is in Texas or it's in Pennsylvania, the response shouldn't be wildly different. But we're not in a, like, that's not the setting we're in with more social science questions about, you know, does this industry have this effect on communities? That's, that relationship is going to be very policy and context dependent. And, but we tend to want to think of a universal relationship, like, you know, higher cholesterol leads to increased risk of heart attack, whether you're in Texas or Pennsylvania. But that's not always the way other sort of causal mechanisms work.
So, Jeremy, you spent time at the White House as chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors. And any experience in any White House is full of challenges and opportunities. Tell us a little bit about how you approached your job and some of the key lessons that came out of your experience and how that sort of interaction influenced or helped you do an optimal job serving at the White House, and then take that forward to the present day. Now that you're back working both in academia, but also for the private sector, how that experience informs what you do now.
Yeah, I'm just organizing my thoughts here because there's a lot that could be said. I'll start with how I thought about my role at the Council of Economic Advisors as time went on. And I thought about it in the way that I write about it in the book. I write the book for this person that I call the policy aide. This policy aide is neither a activist lobbyist on one hand, nor are they this kind of detached academic, all right? They are in between. They are serving a client that has needs, that has questions, that has an agenda. They will best help the client, not by being a data lackey and just like, you know, go get whatever number makes me feel good. Nor are they going to serve the client well if they're this kind of detached, like, I just report the numbers, like, some sort of academic in a lab. They need to take into account the context, and they need to think independently, push back sometimes on what the client thinks is the case, but speak to that client and their unique situation. I liken it to a lawyer with a client in a law case. The client is not served well by a lawyer who says everything that the client wants to hear. The client is served well by a lawyer who says, look, frankly, I think this argument or this strategy is really weak. I don't think the evidence is going to fly with the judge or the jury. And has that type of relationship with the client. Now, the conversation between the client, or let's say the lawyer and the judge, is going to look differently. But that lawyer-client relationship needs to be really frank, and the lawyer needs to be doing independent, principled work and analysis for the interests of the client. That's what I saw myself doing at CEA, serving the chairman, or oftentimes we're writing memos for other components in the executive office of the president. I saw myself in that policy aid role. I'm not the decision maker. I'm not the activist, and I'm not this disinterested and distant academic. I'm something in the middle. And I think that was, you know, I know the chairman at the time when I started, Kevin Hassett, he viewed CEA as having a, you could say this policy aid and less policy making role. We have expertise to push back or critique proposals by others. If we become the main proposer or originator of policy, we lose some of our effectiveness and ability to play, kind of call balls and strikes. And I thought that made a lot of sense. CEA could add a lot of value to the executive branch in general, because we're commenting not just on, you know, what other components of the White House are doing, but on regulations and, you know, regulatory analysis. I thought that was a good role. So, yeah. And then bringing it to today, I have clients for my capstone classes. I've done consulting. And that view of, here, I'm a policy aide. I'm trying to help my client better understand the situation. I'm not trying to give them a vibe. I'm not trying to, I'm kind of on their team, but I'm not just a cheerleader, you know. That's been a really helpful mindset, or you could say a metaphor of the policy aide, as I've worked with state government entities, now working with the city government in Pittsburgh. I've worked with different organizations consulting, and I like that role, and it's the role that's envisioned for the audience in the book.
One of the things that I've think is interesting for probably everybody listening is how much in our daily lives we have statistics thrown at us to either encourage us to do something, discourage us from doing something else, or to affirm choices we've already made, right? From how the big algorithms work to put information in front of our eyes to what we've been trying to convince to do, it always has a recourse in a statistic. Some of the simplest are, hey, 80% of people approve of this, or 70% of people oppose that, to things that are more subtle, but nevertheless trying to move our behavior either as consumers, as individual choosers, as part of a community and the like. You know, going back to kind of Joe's opening question, just keep coming back to, how best should we as just citizens be more aware of this, and what sort of critical tools the average person who has not had the opportunity to sit in your classroom or read the book bring to bear as they're hearing all these claims and sorting them all out for themselves?
Well, to go back to a comment that Joe made at the beginning, that tendency to defer, I would say is not a great tendency. You want to think about the number for yourself, and you don't have to, you know, to fully grasp the number and critique it. Sure, that requires more statistical training than maybe what the average person has, or let's say time than the average person has. But anybody can stop and think about, like, is 2% a big number? Is 1 in 1,000 wells? Is that a big number? When I'll tell you, you know, when you're being duped or having somebody's predisposition just dumped on you, when they throw in just, it's only 1%, or, you know, more than, like, different adjectives that are thrown in to make you think the number is either really small and you should ignore it, or it's really big and you should, like, pay attention and be afraid. And I love using adjectives next to numbers. In the book, I say we must use adjectives. We cannot just, we're not going to be helping people just by reporting measurements. But anybody can throw in an adjective. And this is where bias really comes in, when you just throw in an only, or you throw in a large, without having reasons for them. Like, it just seemed to you as big, or it just seemed to you as small. And then you repeated that when you presented it to the audience or to the reporter. And what I argue for in the book is, it's important to have adjectives. It's even more important to have good reasons for why you selected only, or small, or ignorable, or systemic. Whatever your adjective is, have reasons for it. And we statistics generators would be helped by statistics consumers, who more often ask, wait, is that big? Should I think about it? That is a big number, a large percentage, a very frequent event. Why? It convince me I should be concerned, or I should not be concerned. Give me that assessment, what I call that assessment of magnitude. So that's one thing that I think we all, as statistic consumers, would do well to ask ourselves, or of the person who's the source of the statistic.
Were you able to put that adjectival approach to work when you were at the White House? Did your consumers of the work you were doing have the right sort of mindset to interact with you and appreciate, to your point, that, as Joe said, you know, there needs to be a critical thinking approach to this, but then be able to think through, make sure they understood, and to your point, appreciate how large or how small facts were that were being presented to them inside a statistical framework?
Yeah, I can think of one example where, and it's discussed briefly in the book, where the Commerce Department was recommending that the president impose a restriction on imports of uranium into the United States out of national security concerns. And the Commerce Department, in their analysis, thought that, well, we could require the domestic consumers of uranium, nuclear power plants, to like buy American 25% of their needs before then they go to the international market. And the price that they would be paying wouldn't be much higher than the current market price. Our analysis at CEA suggested a lot higher price was going to be needed for the producers to produce the quantity that the mandate would have required. Just giving, price going up 50%, or I think it would have been more like, you know, doubling, that doesn't really convey magnitude, because doubling of a small number is still a small number, and it might not be that big of a deal. The next step was, okay, if the price doubles and nuclear power plants are paying twice as much for their uranium, how much does that increase their operating costs? Let's go a step further down the line consequences. Okay, if that percent increase in their operating cost, how many are kind of on the verge of profitability and that we might tip into a closure by this increase in cost? And so in this, when I presented this analysis, I wasn't leaning heavily on the adjectives, because especially when you're in a skeptical audience, I think overuse of adjectives can be, people can feel like you're pushing me one way or the other. So instead, I just focused on, okay, we're not going to leave it just as we think prices will go up. We're going to follow that through and look at the consequences for why that doubling of prices translates into some impacts that you don't want to ignore. And so we traced it all the way from the price increase to certain nuclear power plant closings. And I think that really then hit home. Okay, yeah, now I understand the consequence, how big of a deal this requirement would be.
So if you're talking about the potential for shutting down nuclear power plants, you're talking about a decision with some significance. Maybe just give us a little bit of insight, people listening, to the pressure cooker or the process of going through that and making sure that your data is right. I mean, you're working with some smart people. Kevin Hassett's running CEA at the time, correct? During this time frame. Yeah. So he's not stupid, to say the least. And you've got to be bringing some data forward. And at least more than once, I'm just going to say, Jeremy, you must have been a little bit nervous. Is one of these guys going to blow this up? Did I miss something? And it must have been a little bit frustrating when you were talking to junior guys to say, I need you to run this again. Like, this is not a group of dummies. Even the junior people are smart. And probably pound for pound, the CEA crew, pound for pound, just pure wattage brain power that you were working with, yourself included, were the smartest group, right? So walk through that about, and it just your own performance. I mean, did you feel when you were done, you were a better economist after your stint at CEA? And what did you learn from working with those guys?
Yeah, there's a lot there. And I'll start by saying, Kevin's a very capable, very sharp guy. He's in 1,000 channels at once. So Kevin actually, he does internalize what you present, but he leans heavily too on the quality of the people feeding him information. And, you know, he picks good people, he kind of pushes on them. And then I think he kind of gets a sense of folks that he can trust. And, he can't kind of go through and fact check all of his, all the people reporting to him. He can't be doing that. So he's really deferring. So that puts a lot of responsibility and ownership on myself and the CEA staff that I'm working with. So yes, I did feel that weight. And I did lean heavily on the people supporting me. We re-ran things many times, remade figures. I spent a lot of time getting my mind around, there's 5 different pricing, price indices for uranium, for different variations. And I had to get into the weeds of the data, because I didn't want somebody who's like an industry insider from Commerce Department come and blow a hole through my analysis by simply saying the price indices that you're looking at is irrelevant. Nobody pays attention to it because it only covers 5% of the market. You need to be looking at the weighted average contract price on the 90-day delivery for uranium yellow cake, blah, blah, blah. All right. So I had to get into the weeds of the data. I need to call up somebody who does the uranium marketing report at the Department of Energy and really understand, am I using the right data? That's where it starts. That's where I start to build confidence, like at the ground level, understanding the data. And then, you know, the statistical tools and whatnot, I'm more confident with, but it's that, like, this is a subject matter. This is an industry I've not studied before. And as I talk about in the book, good use of statistics and policy is this marriage of the statistical savviness, the understanding of the concept, with the particulars of the context and the subject, the industry, the topic. It's bringing those two together. And that's what I had to do in this case. I was not a uranium expert by any means. I had to bring in my statistical skills and get caught up to speed really quickly. It helped that Commerce had their own team that was trying to undo and poke holes in what we were doing, and I had several calls with them. So it was actually kind of refining to have them have some critiques, and we had some exchanges prior to then the interagency meeting where all the stakeholders were there and I was able to present, because then I already could anticipate their critiques. And at the end of the day, we just, I think, had the argument on our side that their analysis was not nearly as credible. It was based on asking people, you know, how much, if this policy, which is going to increase your profits, were to go into place, would bad stuff happen? That's kind of like what the survey was. And so, you know, you really just had to question, is this reliable? Is this just self-reported data? Versus what I was relying, which was, okay, here are market prices historically. Here's what you actually produced. Have you ever produced as much as you're saying you're going to produce at the prices we've observed in the past, which are higher than what you're, than what we would observe under the policy supposedly? So that just better basic approach, revealed, it's called in economics, a revealed preference approach, ended up being more convincing than self-reported data from the regulated, or the, in this case, the party that was going to benefit from the proposal being considered. So all of that, you know, I think gave me confidence to go in the room and make that argument. And ultimately, I think was more convincing than the commerce argument.
So that's a great example of an anecdote where information and rigorous analysis drove the policy decision process in a place where some of the advocates sounds like didn't anticipate. What is another example from your time at the White House where putting good rigorous analysis on the table really affirmed a recommendation, a set of ideas, a policy course that the administration ultimately went ahead and executed?
I wish I could say that there was more where it's like pretty cleanly, we brought some good data and suddenly people saw the light. As I say in the book, the role of statistics in policy is more varied than people think. It's very rare that a data is going to drive the decision as if, you know, just calculate the right statistics and it's obvious what to do. And it's obvious to everybody. That's rare. But there are cases where, you know, they really help to clarify the situation and guide, maybe not drive, probably not drive, but guide a decision, inform a decision. I'm thinking of during January of 2020, the International Maritime Organization was implementing a sulfur emissions rule on all ships, you know, the whole maritime industry globally. That had been agreed to during the Obama administration. It was a global treaty we had ratified. And there was concern in the administration that this was going to drive up diesel fuel prices in particular. You have this mandate come in and everybody was going to have to switch from basically fuel oil to something that's pretty close to diesel fuel. And that increase in demand for diesel fuel, that's going to drive up costs for your truckers, for your locomotives, and it's going to be a bad thing. And there was concern in the administration that would happen, those price spikes would happen as this mandate, you know, turns on overnight, January 1st, 2020. And the Department of Energy had done their analysis, different industry groups had tried to model everything. And there was conflicting reports as to whether this was gonna be like a huge tsunami type event for energy markets, or if it was going to be just something that happens in the night and few people know about it. I simply look at futures price curves and was tracking, you know, and thinking, again, this is going back to revealed preference. Let's see if people really do think prices are going to spike. And they've got some access to storage capability and there's bunker capacity all over the globe. Why wouldn't they be going out and bidding up the price for diesel fuel, you know, in January of 2020, securing the right to get that deliveries of that diesel fuel? Because if they expect the price to spike, they're going to buy that diesel fuel then that they contracted at some fixed price and resell it at some exorbitant price and become billionaires overnight. And you didn't see that happening. You know, people were not bidding it up. And I brought that to bear. That was one of the kind of key data points. I said, look, futures curves and futures contracts, these are not like accurate predictions of the future. There's just like nobody has a perfect crystal ball. But if people were anticipating this, we would expect them to behave in this way, and that would show up in the data, in the prices. and it wasn't. And I think that helped, allay some fears. And in the end, we didn't do any. The administration didn't do anything. They didn't try to, push back or slow the implementation of the policy. And in the end, the policy came in the night and nobody noticed. It didn't. It had an imperceptible effect on fuel markets.
So that's a good example of maybe something that somebody who's predisposed to have a conservative view of regulation might instinctively say, new regulation coming online, it's going to have a deleterious effect. But you look at some data, price information, which is also very persuasive to conservatives generally, who respect markets, and you're able to say, sorry, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Your gut instinct that this is going to disrupt prices isn't being borne out in the marketplace. There must be something going on. Do you, in your experience in these policy debates, in some cases, strong disputes that we had, was your experience that people wanted to get it right? There's this perception that people are only using statistics to beat the hell out of somebody else and get their way. And certainly we had plenty of meetings, in the various roles that I have and in my career, where I'm being presented with lobbyist information that isn't the whole picture, or because they're advocating, maybe they have tunnel vision. But you take, once you're in, certainly in the White House, my experience was with a couple suspected exceptions that, but maybe I was wrong. For the most part, people wanted to get it right. What did you see about people using data in these policy debates and trying to figure out, even if they are arguing, are they really trying to get it right? Or are they just using data as a weapon?
You had a lot more visibility, I think, to the higher level, to a greater variety of high level decisions. I can certainly say within CEA, people were excited about, enthusiastic for doing good work to get it right. And my colleagues, and when people sense that this was just a go get us a shiny number exercise, there wasn't as much enthusiasm for that. But when there's actually kind of a debate happening about what does it look like to get it right, that's exciting to contribute to. And I think that definitely reflected the spirit of CEA. We push back on each other to get it right. And we didn't always agree on what right looked like. But that was the target. And I saw that in other places, in some of the interagency meetings. I think you also have to recognize getting it right can look differently to different parties that are putting different emphasis on this or that effect or dimension of the issue. When you have those interagency meetings, State Department is concerned about different things than USDA and so on. And that doesn't necessarily mean they don't want to get it right, but they are more sensitive to, they're sensitive to different things. That's a short answer, or medium length answer. Could go into more detail, so I'd say it's a mix. Definitely within CEA, and that's what I could most speak to. We wanted to get it right, and we were excited to be involved in instances where it was clear that there was a real debate happening, and we were feeding into that.
So Jeremy, now that you're back both teaching, writing, consulting, tell us a little bit what your thoughts are about the profession and the discipline of statistics and statistical analysis. What would really help in the education framework to make it a better, more expansive more approachable class or set of classes where students and, you know, just casual practitioners even can draw the right sort of valuable extracts from that educational experience and be able to apply that throughout their lives.
You know, I really think it requires having that the instructors, the people who are teaching these courses, you know, it's just hard to teach what you don't know or have not experienced. And I know that the folks, I know quite a few folks who have done time at CEA, academics who've gone and we go for a year, we go for a year and a half, 2 years at most, and then we're back into academia. Right. Everybody talks about how it changed them. I mean, you can't have that type of experience and not then think differently about what you want to teach, how you want to teach it, what research is interesting and valuable. So I would love to see, especially in policy schools, like that those schools and the professors' teaching staffs would find ways to have more experiences where they're working with clients. I mean, certainly in public universities, I think it's a great thing for universities to be putting themselves, making themselves available to serving the state that they're in, for example. And cases where, you know, especially in schools of public policy, where they're serving, doing analysis for understanding the data needs of a state agency, trying to improve their business, their work, the functioning of their bureaucracy or the function of the policy. Yeah, that exposure and connection with somebody who's making a decision is really valuable for the instructor. And then that's going to bleed into how they teach. I think it's hard to have it happen without the instructors being exposed.
That's great. I think that is probably the way to end this discussion, is to talk about how we can improve statistical instruction moving forward, make it more practical. The last question I've got for you, how about for those of us like Eric and I who are, we slept in late and we didn't take five statistics classes, didn't get the PhD in economics. How, as the client or a colleague, can we best interact with the data and maybe get the most out of the person presenting the data and make sure we're not being BS'd, but also get the best work product out of them?
Well, you did step one right, which is buy the book and read it.
I walked into that one.
So you're already two-thirds of the way there. The not deferring and just asking basic common sense questions about where did this number come from? You know, who is this calculated on? Like, how did you get into the survey that then served as a basis for this number? What did you mean? How was this defined? When you say, such and such institutions, how did you define that criteria that's used to determine who's included in the data and who's not? That is huge. And in many cases, you'll find that the person presenting the statistics doesn't really understand those foundational issues for interpretation. There are some good stats books out there that go through the basics, but I think mine is not meant to be a comprehensive treatment of statistical formulas. It's meant to kind of capture these key principles and insights. So, you know, you can go back and read some more statistics focused, but I don't think the value added is in going through lots of advanced methods or variations on a theme. It is absorbing and understanding some basic ideas. The metaphor I use in the book, and I talked about on Econ Talk, is that of, you know, a chainsaw and a tree. Right? Most statistics textbooks and courses spend a lot of time talking about, here's the chainsaw. This is the theory of the chainsaw, how the chain goes around. All right, and then statistics two is, here's the souped up chainsaw. It goes really fast. It's a 4-foot blade. It's, you know, double the RPM. And so we talk a lot about this chainsaw and explain how the machine works, while never picking it up and saying, all right, now let's cut this tree down that's kind of on close to falling on the garage. All right, well, what separates the person who's going to be able to cut that tree down without creating a disaster is not that they've understand, you know, how the engine works so much better than the other person. It's that they use the basic tool well. They know how to apply the tool in different situations. They know how to angle it into the tree. And so the focus is, you want to get good at statistics, don't soup up in more sophisticated methods for the most part. That's not where the return is. The return is thinking about statistics in different contexts and how they lead to or inform a decision. You know, to continue with the metaphor, it's like you just using that basic chainsaw, the basic base model where the chain just runs, the basic mean, the basic median, the percent of people above the threshold, these basic statistics and concepts like, you know, who are the people that are in the statistic? How is the sample defined? What are the key definitions? What does it mean to have a one unit more value? Like, own all of those key parts, get those right, and the tree's going to fall where it should. Right? That's the key.
Well, I really enjoy that metaphor. If for no other reason, I know I would be a simple wood chip at the end of the chainsaw tree encounter. So, Jeremy, we really appreciate you coming on today. And thank you very much for your time, as well as your expertise and your ability to retail some of what you've learned and how you apply it. It was a real pleasure. To learn more about Jeremy and his book, make sure to check out Statistics for Public Policy, A Practical Guide to Being Mostly Right, or at least Respectably Wrong, on Amazon or from University of Chicago Press, or anywhere books are sold. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, our executive producer, John C.C. Swartacki, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, along with our host, Joe Grogan, this is Eric Euler. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.
This has been DCEKG. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. While you're at it, leave us a rating and review to help others find out about the show.